Thank you. Actually, I was working here for some time between my Fermilab and CERN transition. Mike Witherell was my director, and the faculty here at Santa Barbara were my leaders, both while at the time at CBF, and then we all went on to continue at CERN. I also want to say that this clip was completely unscripted, so there was no planning on the exercise, on the questions, and there was no planning on where, which streets we were going. And my video camera man was a student who is now a professor in artistic expression of science. So he's doing, he's in a college in New York, and he's doing this type of mediating science. He was a particularly good, I would say, in computation and in theory. He was at Fermilab and Columbia, and now he's a professor in New York. So the universe in collisions, not on fire, although if we take the last week and the last year at the LHC, maybe the universe, maybe the fire in the universe is the right way of starting. But what I wanted to start with is the Obama's top 100 words when during his campaign, and this was from the science debate 2008. You see that research, science, energy, technology are among the top of his words. I think this and the fact that science took such a big part of this campaign was why one of the top three scientific achievements in the year 2008 from the Science magazine, from the Scientific American top 10, the first of the top three was in fact the election as a scientific achievement. And this is a map of the US. This is a professor of Michigan has made the map of in a very high resolution of how many votes were casted Republican and how many votes were casted Democrat. The second achievement was touching Mars. So NASA last May touched down on Mars, and this was a very big achievement for the year 2008. Indeed, it was rated number two. And number three achievement was the LHC. The LHC, although it's not running, it's completed. It's being constructed from the design, from the conception to the design to being down in the tunnel. It's approximately 25 years. In 1993, when President Clinton canceled the SSC, was when the European Commission approved the continuation of the LHC. So in a sense, the SSC and the LHC are the same project in terms of the intellectual progress in knowledge. So this was number three. Now, in Time CNN, which is a little bit more popular in terms of people, let's say, the number three, so the countdown here, I started from three. On the previous one, I started from one. Number three was Craig Venter with his achievement on what he's trying to do with putting together life, with putting together 580,000 bases of the DNA and programming it and making synthetic programmable DNA and continuing on with putting together something like an organism or altering organism, altering organisms. The guy, you know him from the mapping of the genome, and he was number three for his achievements. Number two in the same position as in the scientific, more scientific, let's say, magazine, is again touching on Mars. It's a big achievement. Last May, NASA managed that. And number one in the eyes of CNN Time was, in fact, the LHC and the experiment of the LHC. So it seems that science has dominated in many ways, political and across all sciences and technology in 2008, as I told you. So I wanted to say that when the director of this institute here was very esteemed, and he's very much appreciated around the world for his, not only for his knowledge, for his Nobel, and for who he is as a person, but also for his advice in science. He is giving us advice, and he's talking, when he's talking to people and to lab directors and to the labs, he's talking about the coming revolutions in fundamental physics. And I think part of the coming revolutions in fundamental physics will be the LHC. And as I will explain to you, as I will describe to you, there is an issue with the balance, with the budget of the universe. So it's not just the economy here on Earth that is having issues. The actual budget of the universe, of what it is and how we account for it and how much we understand it, is not settled. Let's say. So so I think the LHC might be a part of this bailing out of the universe. And here on the last two small pictures, I have a picture of the bullet cluster in different wavelengths, if you want. So there is a part which is the optical part that we can see with our eyes. And then there is part of the of this cluster, for example, that you can see with X-rays, and that's the red one. And there is a part that you cannot see really in any other way other than gravitational lensing observationally. And we will see a little bit in the homework later how else you can actually derive it, like Vicky derived it many, many years ago. And that is a part that it's out of the budget. It doesn't, the books doesn't do not balance because of this. It's called the dark matter of the universe. And if we want to see in the pie how big is this dark matter of the universe that we don't know what it is, it would be 5 times bigger than what we know, the ordinary matter. And I will talk about that quite extensively. But about that, I will talk a little bit, but what we are going to know, we're going to know when we know, when we have the experiments. We have the observations that the dark matter is there, but we don't know what it is, okay? What kind of fundamental particle or particles make up this dark matter? And of course, you see the big blue here, which is the dark energy. I'm going to talk just tiny little bit about this, which is really AIG or worse, okay? Before I get into the LHC, I want to tell you about scales. And again, I'm going to be talking about billions because it's a fashionable. So we're going to be talking about billions of meters or billionths of meters. Now, when we do science, and it's all science, our science is targeting some particular scale. In other words, when Craig Venter is doing the DNA and the mapping of the genome, he is talking about phenomena, chemical phenomena, if you want, that are happening at length scales of 10 to the minus 9 meters, so billions of meters. When we are talking about Newtonian physics and gravity and the planetary system, we're talking about billions of meters. Now, most of this type of physics, which is inanimate in a sense that there is no, we're not talking here, here we're talking about chemistry and also about life phenomena. The chemistry of this type of physics we know very well, the life phenomena of this type of physics we don't know very well, how it's being put together and why it is alive and how it's happening. So there is a lot going on, and as you know, much going on in the world of the genetics and biogenetics of this scale, on this scale. On this scale, there is a lot that we don't know, but most of the physics, most of the explanation of the natural phenomena in this scale, we do know. As well as we do know the 10 to the 9 times 10 to the 9, the galaxies, we do know. We do not know the fundamentals of how the universe started in order to have these galaxies as they are. But how they are, what they are made of, we actually do know. There comes now, so this is the trio right here. And now we're coming into the trio right here. And we are talking about scales at the LHC, length scales, and all of these scales, when I say meters, you can translate meters into energy, or into time, or into other units. Physicists like to do this kind of thing. But if we want to say about the LHC, what is the scale of the LHC? Then the scale of the LHC would be a very intriguing scale of where in nature the matter, mass and matter is happening. So it's the scale, we call it the electroweak scale, or the tera scale if we want to be a little more dramatic. But it is the scale where the W and the Z bosons, and those are carriers of the electroweak force, are getting mass. This is not, as you go and do atomic physics or chemistry or other type of physics, and you go into smaller scales or into bigger scales, there may be scales that are more important than the others because phenomena unveil themselves in that scale and not in the previous scale. That's how we discovered particles. In some, as we went into smaller and smaller scales, there were some scales that they were showing us a plethora of new phenomena, and some scales that they were showing us they were barren, that nothing was there. So the importance of this scale is exactly the fact that the W and the Z bosons are acquiring mass, and the W and the Z bosons, which, as I said, are the carriers of this electroweak force, are not to be taken lightly. I will say one word about the Higgs boson, but register this now, commit this to memory, that the W and the Z are the quantum faces of the Higgs, that those faces that we know. So the Higgs we don't know. We have not found it. We are looking for it. But the Higgs has quantum faces, okay? And two of these, or three in fact, together with a photon, we do know. So important scale. Why else is this scale important? This scale is important because other than the Higgs, there is a very good chance that the previous budget that I show you on dark matter can also be explained by particles that are being created in this scale. And these are the superparticles that you saw also a little bit. I asked people on the clip 10 years ago. We are going to talk about these particles a little bit more. But this is a scale that it is intriguing for many reasons, and we're looking forward to breaking into that scale. And it is also not different in terms of actual numbers, not too different, let's say, in many orders of magnitude from what the Tevatron has been doing. So the Tevatron is called the Tevatron because it is entering the TeV scale, if you want. So it is exploring the TeV scale. And with a factor of 7 as the energy, we are going to the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. Now, this is the afterbreath of the universe, the afterbreath of the Big Bang. This is, if you took the temperature of the universe all around, you would find the cosmic microwave background map, which is this one from the WMAP satellite, and this is probing one more billion more scale. So we're going into the scale now of the universe. And then we're going into the scale of where we're going into the scale that we really should remain silent unless we're David Grosch and have a Nobel Prize. Because in that scale, phenomena that, well, I will say also, and especially also if we're experimentalists, in that scale, in order to extrapolate what kind of phenomena theoretically could be there and what kind, how they are connected with the experiments that we're doing, it's a very difficult scale. It's the scale where gravity becomes as weak as the other, as strong as the other forces. It is a scale where quantum mechanics and gravity are tying in together. It is a scale where all the forces are becoming, are unified. It's a very difficult scale to talk about, experimentally, at least. But the issue here with all these scales is that this one can give a clue about both of these ones. So this corner here, and this is why I call this the LHC as bailing out. It can give us something about the dark matter. It can give us something about the dark energy, possibly, and I will say something about that with the Higgs. And if there is anything of string theory that it is being manifested in this scale, we have to see. There is the Large Hadron Collider. It's a machine that it's in the border of France and Switzerland. There is two large experiments, multi-purpose experiments, the ATLAS and the CMS experiments across each other. There are more experiments around the ring. In fact, the LHC is supporting now something like seven different experiments. There is an experiment about understanding antimatter with the B quarks, dedicated experiments for quark gluon plasma and heavy ion collisions. And so I'm mostly going to talk about those two when I'm talking about the physics, but that doesn't mean that the rest is less important or less in priority. I want to say a few words about the magnets. And this has been a source of grief for us in the past year with the problem that we have with the magnets, and I will show you pictorially how painful it was. The success of the LHC and the prerequisite of the LHC, in order to keep in this 27-kilometer ring 70 eV per beam, the only way you could do that, you start with two conditions, and the only way you can do that is that you manage to have 8.3 Tesla magnets around the ring to keep the beams in place. You started with if you had a smaller ring, you would have even to have, or if you have a bigger ring or a smaller ring, you would have to have different kind of fields. For this one, this is the field that was required, and in that time even, it was impossible technologically to build it. They said, we're going to build it with super magnets, such that it is very strong, but it was not demonstrated that this was working even. And in fact, the design of the LHC is a double design in one magnetic structure to have two beams that go the other direction when both of the beams have the same charge. This is completely untrivial, as you can imagine. You, with protons and antiprotons, you could say that, okay, with the same magnet, they can go the other way. But with protons and protons, it was completely a non-trivial thing. And in fact, it was first built in Brookhaven by Blewett and was proposed for the SSE even. But eventually, it was materialized for the LHC, this double structure design for the superconducting dipole. In addition to those magnets, there are approximately 10,000 additional magnets at the LHC because the beam has to be manipulated, has to be squeezed, has to be sent to different directions, has to be in all directions, has to be manipulated in order to bring the particles in collisions appropriately and produce the physics that we want. Also, I should say that there are billions of protons per per bunch, per beam of the two circulating beams. So one word, the discovery physics scope of the LHC, we're going to see this re-entering in the, throughout the lecture. The discovery physics scope of the LHC, in no particular order of importance, let's say, maybe in order of what my prejudices that we are going to find first, is to characterize the new particles that compose the dark matter of the universe. And I say here particles and not particles. It can be that the dark matter of the universe is not one particle. If you want to think about the visible matter of the universe, that it is the lightest one and it doesn't decay and it is stable, it is the electron, the up and the down quark that everything is made of. And it's not one particle, it is three, and the electron neutrino. Find the Higgs particle, a new particle, and new forces, new dimensions, if there are. The new dimensions, I will say, from the point of view of the theory, they are degrees of freedom. Every time you add a dimension, you are opening up the calculation in order to absorb abnormalities that you would have in smaller number of dimensions. If there is physics in that, however, in other words, if the extra dimension is a physical entity, we are going to be able to observe the results in the particle collision. Here it is. In some of the cases, they said that, in the public at least, they said that what we're trying to do is to collide protons with protons at very high energy, as it was done previously at the Tevatron with matter-antimatter, with proton-antiprotons. And we tried to recreate the Big Bang, for example. But here, I have a small graphic that shows here are the two beams colliding and how it will happen, okay? So all this is in the future tense. And then on the approximately 100 meters, actually it's in the plane, 100 to 70 meters, there is one of these two detectors, the one that was built in situ. This is the large toroidal LHC apparatus ATLAS that was built. And in the little clip of the 9 seconds, it was covering approximately 2.5 years or 3 years of installation in here. I told you that
the Large Hadron Collider promises to reveal the smallest building blocks of nature by recreating conditions that existed moments after the Big Bang. This begs the question, why the would you recreate the Big Bang? Does that not sound a bit dangerous?
Okay, so this appeared actually in the in the David Stewart show approximately a week ago, okay? So the media have shown that we are trying to recreate the Big Bang and how what are we doing and why are colliding particles and so on and so forth. And I think in that show it was the first time that they got it right, also with the black holes story, okay? So I will say a few words about particle physics, high energy particle physics, and why we are colliding particles at very high energy. So when you bring particles to very high energies, you are bringing, they have extremely small wavelengths, so they can probe subatomic distances. That means that the particle accelerators are like a super microscope. It's like going from the optical to all the way down, so that you can resolve lengths of the scale that we were talking before. You cannot do this with other kind of telescopes. You have to, this is why the with the microscopes. This is why they are called super microscopes. The telescope is actually a Freudian slip because the telescope and the microscope and the small and the big at the LHC and together with the cosmic observations are coming together. In science today. Now, the higher the energy, the closer the particle come to each other, and so the more details they are revealing to each other. And in addition, the energy of the collision can produce new particles. You all know the E equals mc squared. The higher the energy, the higher is the mass of the new particle that can be created. And so for a particle that is moving with momentum px, py, and pz in the x, y, and z axis, and if we consider c equals 1 as we usually do, then this is the mass that, of the particle that you are going to be creating. So the higher the energy, the higher the mass. Now, that looks like you are going to have a collision of two Mini Coopers and produce a bulldozer in some cases. And this is what happened at the Tevadron. The Tevadron is the place where the top quark was produced by the collision of protons and antiprotons. And so there is a scope in why we are accelerating particles, why we are colliding, and what does it mean that we're getting into these high energies. Now, I want to say something about the scientific method because, and part pointing to some of the particle physics questions traditionally in the past 50 years. These questions are not anymore the same because, as I told you, we are confronted with observations of cosmology that have been giving us tremendous amount of data and knowledge that we have to comprehend in the context of both type of sciences. But in classical particle physics, if you want, the questions we are asking is if there is a small number of distinct objects from which the universe is made, is there a small number of simple rules to explain how these objects mesh together to make everything we know? And with everything, I will repeat. It's the yellow part plus the red part of that pie. The big blue remains a very big problem. And what kind of observations in what kind of laboratories can we make to study this? And the answer to this, we all know, in the recent years, it has been for the Tevatron, and now it's going to be the LHC. Before that, it was LEP and other colliders. So the way this type of experimentation and answering this question goes is like trying to learn how to play chess not by knowing the rules, but by looking at the shapes and the pieces and how they move, and then you figure out the rules. This is what we are doing when we are analyzing these collisions. So we don't have a manual from before to know what is happening. So, and how do we go about getting the answers? And that's the scientific method that I'm talking to you about is the Francis Bacon scientific method that is being taught in science and philosophy forever, is we make a guess and we compute the physical consequences. And this can be done first or secondly. We observe and we measure, depending. There were people that they observed something and then they made a guess what it was. There are people that they made a guess and then they looked, was something there of what they guessed. So one and two are interchangeable. And then you compare the consequences and you see how the guess compares with the measurement, how the theory compares with the measurement. Usually, if the data is telling you that the theory cannot be, usually that's what it is, and it doesn't matter if how good the theory appears or how beautiful the person who made the theory is. The data tells you that is not the case, and the data is the data. You have to respect the data. There have been cases in the history of all science where also the data happened to be wrong. But this is why we have more than one experiment to be checking each other so that we avoid this problem. And in the case of that I showed you, this is what ATLAS and CMS are complementary in each other. So we say that, in fact, we are seeing the structure of the matter by using accelerators at high energies, going from atoms to nuclei to nucleons and quarks. That was the story of high energy physics, and that was the top quark at the Tevatron, how it appeared in our detectors. And I will say something about antimatter because 2 days from today, I think there is the big angels and demons premiere. And I haven't read the book and I haven't seen the movie, but I will tell you something about antimatter, and then when you see the movie, think about it. So particle accelerators create antimatter by smashing high-energy particles onto a bunch of metals. The total amount of antimatter produced in particle accelerators per year is about a microgram. And now that would provide energy, of course, to drive a car for a month if you use A equals MC squared. Now, those were the actors. They appeared at CERN. We didn't see them, but it was all kept very, very secretively. But apparently in that book, somebody is moving antimatter on some buckets and is destroying the Vatican or something. So now the homework problem here is how much antimatter would take to blow up the Vatican. Can we stop the video for this, please? And how long would it take to produce this antimatter? I don't put CERN here because we usually say that at Fermilab we make more antimatter. Now CERN says that they make more antimatter, or about the same. So this is a dispute that we're not going to solve now. But I will tell you that about 1 kiloton of TNT is 4.2 times to the 20 joules, and if we do all the calculation, that would require 50 million years of running in order to happen what they are planning in the book. I will go back a little bit to high energy physics before we had accelerators. I want to remind everyone that, and that is kind of a circle, let's say, it is impressive for me that high energy physics started with cosmic rays. Cosmic rays were the highest energy particles that the universe was accelerating, and we were started observing in the beginning of the century. This is where accelerators actually, this is when we could not have enough rates of observing. We thought of how do we recreate the phenomenon in the lab? And then we started building accelerators. And we have a long way since then, when we are returning back to observing the phenomena in the universe and trying to combine with what we are finding in the accelerator. So here, for example, I show you a cosmic ray shower from a proton that is falling onto nuclei, creates cascades of different kinds of particles. All these particles we found in the lab, first by observing the reactions that were happening from the cosmos, and then by recreating them. So that proton there that came from the cosmos, where could it come from? It could come from one possible source was a supernova, for example. There are many possible sources of where protons are coming in. If you are watching the news, you are going to be hearing, you have been hearing, and you're going to be hearing more about observations of the rates of protons, antiprotons, electrons, antielectrons from satellites and balloons, that they are also trying to figure out, is there any source other than normal particles? For example, is there antimatter that could be the source of observations in the universe from this type of observations? Other, not, in other words, not the accelerator. So I just wanted to say again a little bit of history, that when from when the electron was discovered in the 1900s, all the way to the 60s, when all of a sudden there was plethora of particles that we discovered. This was a time that these particles, there were observation and the guess was not even there. What are these particles? Why are they there? So the plethora of these new particles were called hadrons, and they were discovered in accelerators. Now, the Large Collider in Geneva is called the Large Hadron Collider. Does anyone know here what a hadron is? No. So they didn't call it a large proton collider, okay, to make it simpler. They called it a Large Hadron Collider. That means that protons are hadrons, and I will show you a little bit about that. Aggregates of quarks. They didn't know at that time when they were finding them that they were aggregates of quarks. But when you put quarks together, you make hadrons, okay? So, and all hadrons are made of quarks. And the director of this institute here got the Nobel Prize for understanding the behavior of the quarks, the fundamental state. So we've got the protons. The Large Hadron Collider could be called normally the Large Proton Collider. But we've got a lot of hadrons, and here is a map of them. If you put combinations of quarks together, you get hadrons. So don't let anyone fool you on the street if they ask you, do you know what a hadron is? You know now. It's the aggregate of quarks being put together. So now for acceleration, we've got many ways to accelerate, but three are the basic ways. You drop things, you shoot them, or you put them on a merry-go-round and you push them. This is the main, basically the three ways that we are accelerating particles. So, and we use them in sequence. We drop, we shoot what fell, and then we go merry-go-round and we push them to the very high energy. I don't know if we have time for this, so I will come back later. That was an animation of the protons going around. Depending on how many of you want to see it in the end, I will play it. It's about 4 minutes, and it's a graphic of how you start from a bottle of hydrogen, you strip off the electrons, you keep the proton of the hydrogen, and you start accelerating. But I will take a poll in the end because David got to the 9 minutes in the beginning, and we don't want to stay here all night. So here are the dipoles. This was the last dipole that arrived at CERN a couple of years ago and went down in the tunnel. This is the design that I told you, the dual core design of the magnet that was prototyped. The first prototype, in fact, was done in Brookhaven, and the first scientific paper on this was by Bluett. So in Brookhaven, also sometime in the middle 70s, I would say. Importantly, those superconducting dipoles, they need to be operating at very cold temperatures. And in order to be at these cold temperatures, you need cryogenics and approximately 90 tons of liquid helium and 1,000 tons of liquid nitrogen. I will say that the technology of bringing these magnets down to this low temperature is impressive to no end. These people have even valves that they are high temperature superconductors in order to go from one phase of cooling to the other phase of cooling. Kudos to the accelerator people and the cooling people. It's highly non-trivial, and as a technological accomplishment, is really, really amazing. Now, that's a picture that showed this is a dipole, okay? And this is here, those parts here are the interconnects. Now, when I teach my students, in undergraduate students, the next time, a lab which is called the Zap Lab, where they have a home kit, a take-home kit with a soldering iron, a solder, and a lot of capacitors and other stuff. Soldering is extremely important. I will say that. And the way you do it is extremely, extremely important. These are the interconnects where we had the problem in the last year. And here is one of the pictures how you interconnect the dipoles. Okay, that is, I showed you the real view on the surface. That is the schematic view, CMS. Compact muon solenoid does not mean a solenoid made of muons, a compact solenoid made of muons or anything like that. It means a detector that it has a very strong solenoidal magnetic field. Therefore, it's compact, because the more strong is the field, the smaller can be the detector. And it was made to observe muons very well. ATLAS, ALICE, and LHCb are around the ring. And what I told you before is that we've got billions of protons per bunch at 7 TeV. So it doesn't matter how you shake it. If you make the calculation, you don't want all this energy. You don't want to have an accident. And we didn't have an accident with particles in, so we were extremely lucky. But it is not allowed to have another one, let's say, at any conditions at this point. These are some pictures down the tunnel of that was on one side the dipole and on the other side a straight section. This is another straight section going to the injection tunnel. This is close to Atlas, that one. This is after the 10th of September where we had the circulation, both circulation of beam 1 and beam 2. Beam 1 was the blue one, beam 2 is the red one. We had the problem that there was an arc in one of these interconnects, which to first order it means some soldering went bad, okay, simply said. And the dissipation of the energy didn't go as it should. And the point is not that there was an explosion that created all this problem. The point is that when you have all this helium, let me show you here. Here is how the interconnect is. So you've got the superconducting cable, and the copper stabilizer, and then you've got a thin silver soldering alloy layer, and that's the complete junction. The total current when the accident happened was 9,000 amps. The total current when we've got 70 EV is 12,500 amps. So it was above the 5,000. Okay, so namely it was above the 5 TV. It was approximately 9,000. And they were testing it at that point in order to actually be able. Immediately after we circulated the beams, that was the last sector that was not tested, and we were testing it in order to actually try and put collisions. And because we had the accelerator people had a little bit more time for this, they tried to do it during this time window that they had. So it could have been the case that we would have collisions, the first test collisions at 1 TeV per beam, or 450 GV per beam already that week. This is what the accelerator division was trying to do. So that is the junction. And what happened, however, it's not just that some interconnect went well. What happened is that if you've got 6 tons of liquid helium, okay, and they come to from the temperature of 1.6 to room temperature, the volume of this thing is going to be up by a factor of order 1,000. So what happened is in the jackets around that the helium was there, you created a shock wave with the helium going around, and at the first barrier the helium found, it knocked it out. So the magnets that they were mostly affected were not the magnets at the actual place of the bad interconnect, they were the magnets at the first barrier. All right, and that was a soliton, let's say, shockwave type of accident. On the other hand, during that, hundreds of magnets quenched extremely properly and transmitting the current to a damper resistance, and that is an exercise that is unique to be done. You don't want it, but that is unique. It happened, and all of this worked extremely properly. The schedule that the management of the lab gave then is exactly what has happened. The last dipole went in, everything is fixed, we're getting ready. So I will go very quickly on to a few subjects about what we are going after, LHC and in general in high energy physics. And before I go to that, I will just give you a little bit of the composition of the universe and especially the matter particles and how they are held together by means of interaction particles or force particles. So we've got what we call the fermions. These are the quarks that make up the hadrons that we are accelerating because we're going to make all these quarks collide, and the leptons. And then we've got the bosons, and we've got I told you, we've got the W and the Z, which are the faces of the Higgs that we haven't found, the photon that is transmitting the electromagnetic interactions, and we've got something also that we haven't found, which is the graviton. the way we are describing all these things in particle physics is in terms of space, in terms of space and time. We've got incoming particle, outgoing particle, another incoming particle. Instead of putting them back to back and make a collision like that, this is how we represent them. And the interaction that is happening, we represent it usually with wiggly lines. Something is mediating some force when they're coming together. In this case, the incoming particle is an electron and another one, the photon, and then you've got outgoing particles. So the wiggly line, this is the language that we are using, where the wiggly lines are forces and the straight lines are matter particles. And all this picture of the yellow part of the pie that I showed you in the beginning, we call the standard model. And the standard model is basically the list of the particles and their quantum numbers. The quantum numbers of the quantum numbers of the particles is their social security number, their address, where all of their information of how you characterize them and uniquely find them. This is the quantum numbers. And about 20 numbers that specify the strength of the interactions. This we call the coupling. And also a mathematical formula, which part of it can be written here in a piece of paper. It talks. This is the part that it is talking about the photons and the Higgs. The other part, the difficult part, is the quantum chromodynamics part. This you cannot fit in this part. In this, it's much shorter. Or you can fit it, and it's much shorter. Okay. So we've got leptons, quarks, and gauge bosons to commit to memory. Many of them, and with different kinds of quantum numbers. So they come right-handed or left-handed. These are the neutrinos, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, the tau neutrino, the leptons, the lepton family. Then we've got the quarks, and they also come in many with many quantum numbers. The left and the right here is showing the left-handedness or right-handedness, the helicity, the status one of the quantum numbers that describes them uniquely. And the gauge bosons, we said, the faces of the Higgs, the W and the Z. And then we've got the gluons. This is the glue among the quarks, the Higgs and the graviton that we haven't found, plus all the antiparticles. Okay? So the standard model with all these particles explain the yellow part of the pie, explain how atoms, nuclei, the natural phenomena, the neutrinos, the nuclear reactions in the sun, the stars, explain all of that phenomena. A few of the phenomena that the standard model does not explain is, for example, quantum gravity, what is happening exactly in black holes, for example. What is the dark matter, the red? What is the dark energy? This the standard model does not explain. And also, the standard model does not have a big part of it, which is we haven't found a big part for the standard model, which is the Higgs particle. And now the situation of the standard model with the Higgs particle, namely with having electroweak symmetry breaking and understanding the source of the mass of the particles, is still precarious. Even if we find the Higgs, we are in a situation that you would have to put a chair on one foot and arrange it so delicately that it will not fall down in 19 minutes with the Higgs found. Now, mathematically, this is possible, but in reality, as anyone who will try, it is extremely difficult to achieve. And here is a cartoon about the Higgs. So if you think that this is Obama, when he gets in the room and he goes to the podium and it takes a lot of time because he has to greet all these people, this is how, in a cartoonish way, the Higgs giving mass to the particles is explained. Now, the story about the Higgs is much more peculiar, I would say. The Higgs is very peculiar because I told you in the beginning there are particles that have spin one and spin one half. There's bosons and fermions. And then there are these ones that they have spin zero, and we do not have an elementary particle that has spin zero. The only one that we think we might have is the Higgs. Having spin zero means that not only it interacts with everyone else and gives mass to everyone else, but it interacts with itself and gives mass to itself. So this Higgs field is an intriguing, very intriguing field. Now, the Leon Lederman, in the beginning, when he wanted to write the God Particle book, he didn't name it the God Particle book. He named it the God Damn Particle book, because we have been trying to find this particle for a long time and we haven't. And his editor then had to cut short the title. Now, how can we go, see? So if we assume we even have the Higgs, we have a problem in terms of how we think about it, because we are in the situation of the chair on the one leg. So how can we stabilize a little bit the story there in order to be in a situation that it is a little more natural? The way we can do it is by what we call supersymmetry or superdimensions. And that basically, as in Dirac's case, when matter doubled and became antimatter, in that case we would have matter and supermatter. And the way to do that would be having a symmetry between bosons and fermions. So for every one of the bosons, we would have a partner. There would be a fermion, and likewise for the fermions, that would double again the spectrum of the particles. This is what we call supersymmetry. If we have supersymmetry and the Higgs particle, we are coming, because supersymmetry has, in fact, not one, but five Higgs particles, we are coming to a point that the chair has become in this situation. So we are in a less precarious situation in terms of how stable are things, in terms of how we understand them. Of course, we have doubled the spectrum. And here comes an interesting part, that the lightest of these particles could be one of the dark matter candidates. So we may have an answer, and the theory was not made for that. We double the spectrum of all the particles, and the lightest of these supersymmetric particles could be what explains the red part of the pie. In fact, one of the students that I had when I was at Fermilab was a student at IMSA, and she did one type of searches with me looking for this type of particle already when she was at the high school. She's now finishing graduate school at MIT. Now, I will go back a little bit to the dark matter. And the reason is because we have observations from the universe that fit very well, that not fit very well, that give us, it's an observation, that there is matter out there that we cannot account or see in any other way other than gravitational interaction. And so it is very interesting to try and understand what this type of matter could be made of. This is one of the Coma galaxy cluster, one of the ones that they have been studied, and there is a factor of five between the matter that you would calculate for this and the matter that actually is visible matter, the matter that belongs to the yellow part of the pie that we can understand. And this is the X-ray part of the Coma, which is what we can see in the X-ray spectrum. So the homework problem is, if we know that the gas observed by Chandra has a radius of about 1 megaparsec from this picture, this is actually a homework that one can solve easily. So this one, if this is 1 megaparsec, what is the total mass, including what the dark matter that is inside the radius? So this is a calculation that I think even Zwicky did in the beginning when he started talking about the dark matter, that the kinetic energy is half of the potential energy. This is called the virial theorem. Now, we were going to take a ready number from Chandra, that this is 10 keV, and if we solve for knowing that the r comma is 1 megaparsec from the observation, if we solve this series here by equating the kinetic energy with the potential energy, we are going to find that the mass of the comma, the expected mass of the comma, is 5 × 10^14 solar masses. Now, if you do this calculation and then you say, well, the comma is a big cluster. A big cluster has about 1,000 galaxies. A galaxy has about 10^11 stars. One star is about the mass of a solar mass. If you put together these numbers, you're getting just 10^14 solar masses. So the factor of 5 that they had seen in the beginning, and somebody will jump and say, what are the errors on that? And I'm going to say you are right. But the factor of 5 was, in fact, the factor of 5 that was missing from the calculation because of the dark matter. Now, what is not dark matter? One can start and think, what could it be in dark matter that it's visible, but we haven't accounted for it, we haven't thought really well about it? It cannot be the gas, it cannot be the stars, it cannot be mostly planets or mostly neutrinos. It probably cannot be mostly black holes. And so, from all what we have looked at, it is some kind of new matter. And it probably is heavy, and it interacts very weakly with ordinary matter, otherwise we would have seen it. And it probably also interacts weakly with its own kind. At these particle collisions, with very high energy particle collisions, if supersymmetry really offers us the candidate that we think is good for dark matter, we might be able to produce it. And if we produce it, it will be looking in a detector as an imbalance of energy. Now, these graphs mean very little, but what they actually encapsulate is that whatever you put in terms of energy and momentum, that much you have to go out. If there is an imbalance again, you call it missing energy. So the equation doesn't come out. Something is missing. What could it be missing? One of the candidates that could be missing, because it interacts weakly with ordinary matter, it escapes the detector, it is a dark matter particle. And usually in these interactions, there are two of them in the end of the chain. So far I told you about the phases of the Higgs and dark matter. In fact, these are the experimental evidences that we have today that in this scale, we will expect to discover a sector of particles that is associated with electroweak symmetry breaking. That means giving mass to the particles, i.e. Higgs-like mechanism, and dark matter. So this is why we are looking for SUSY or SUSY mutation. For SUSY, I mean supersymmetry. And I will say here that when we make the plan for supersymmetry, it's not only one supersymmetry that could be there, or two types of supersymmetry. The different theoretical scenarios, the different realizations of supersymmetry, and other supersymmetry-like theories is infinite. We can narrow it down, but the theory space that could give you the same signatures is very, very huge. And the signatures that we are looking at the LHC is a very large list. Now, here some of the professors that are working at CMS, they are doing a very intense and great job into categorizing this. And this is coming to the problem which has been tagged as the inverse LHC problem. When we see something, will we be able to say what it is, or will we be hanging for some time? If we see phenomena arising right and left and excesses, will we be able quickly to answer, what is it that we saw of all of these possible realizations? And this is a real serious issue. In this list, you don't need to read it, but this is different signatures where you can find an excess or a deficit, possibly, and you will have to explain it. So this is what I called, is it the amoeba or Sharon Stone? Is it an amoeba or is it Sharon Stone problem? And again, it goes back to the DNA analogy. How do you decode the composition of primary constituents? So just like decoding the DNA, we have to decode the signals of what we find at the LHC. And we expect more similarities than differences. So we have to have our head ahead of time sample the theory space, understand the signatures so that we are not looking like goofballs when we have the discovery and we don't know what it is. And that means also that we have to be working very close with our theory collaborators. And now I will go very quickly on a slideshow of how the detectors look like. So the first one was the Atlas we saw on the clip. This is the CMS. The CMS was assembled on ground. The Atlas was assembled underground, 100 meters underground. You see a little bit of trivia here, how much they weigh, 7,000 tons and 12,000 tons for Atlas and CMS. CMS is heavier. Atlas can float on the Lake Geneva if you throw it on a plastic bar. And if you compare it with, for example, a Boeing 747 or the Endeavour Space Shuttle, Atlas is heavier, and the CMS is heavier than USS John McCain. The size of the collaborations are huge. This is unprecedented on how many different countries, institutions, students, technicians, engineers comprise the full collaboration. We are reaching, in terms, and I'm not talking about only the scientific authors, but in terms of the people who have contributed in these experiments, it is a huge number of people. So it's not only that we have 100 millions of channels that we are, electronics channels that we are collecting data from, but we have up to 5,000 people that they have worked in order to build this and to make it happen. I'm going to go faster now. Here is again from the assembly of the CMS. The detectors look like concentrical cylinders where you capture the energy of the particles. This is the largest superconducting solenoid magnet, with the highest stored energy. You can find things like that in medical science with a Tesla, four Tesla field, but not with the diameter that you can put a hammer in it. This is huge. There is no prototyping for it, by the way. You cannot have a bench test where you put a small, I mean, this is the prototype and you have to use it. And when we put it, when we powered it 2 years ago, we were in awe. And it worked, and it worked perfectly. I'm sorry? Yes, it is a very big, it's 2.7 gigajoules, so it's the most energetic magnets ever built. This is the test that we had when we closed the CMS detector. This is when we brought it down at 100 meters, down the cavern. We needed to get from the Pacific Ocean one of these cranes that they are used in oceanographic recovery of ships or such. This is a visit of Stephen Hawking that he together with the management. This is the first warning that we had in the local media, when they were making fun of all the international media, that they were making people afraid of all what could come out. There was one more of these with dragons, with real dragons emerging out of the detector. The three more bullets on the LHC, other than the very high energy, which makes the detectors very, very challenging, not only because of radiation, which is extremely, extremely important. So everything has to be radiation hard, everything has to be radiation resistant. The scintillators and whatever we are using must not die because of the high radiation environment. Also, the particles look different. A muon at the Tevatron and the muon at the LHC are not the same beast. They are behaving differently, and their interaction with matter is different. So we have to restudy all the phenomena. Other than that, the high energy, we have high luminosity, which means high rates of data coming in, which brings us to the grid, which you heard, you might have heard, the revolution in networking and how the World Wide Web is turning out into the grid world is also assisted by what we need there. And I'm closing smoothly here. So since the time of Fermi, it took the LHC, I would say the Tevatron also, but for sure it will take the LHC that brings theory and experiment very close together, which is a very good thing. The cost is of the order of 10 billion. You know where this is coming. Now, since the time of Fermi, it took the threat of the LHC to bring theory on shell, that means the string theorists actually are thinking about experiments. This is a very good thing. The theory on shell means, what it means is that when a particle is not on shell, it's a little bit off the ground, it needs to shed photons and ground it, get grounded, come to a ground state. So theory for a long time was somewhere else, and now we think it's back with us, and the cost of that is 10 billion. And getting finally to experimental discoveries, MasterCard, priceless. Now I will give you a very nice picture that I stole from Ian Shipsey, a colleague of mine in Purdue. So the standard model, the standard model, we call it standard, but it's extremely, extremely extraordinary. It is a very successful model. It is important. We call it standard because I think we're physicists and we have sometimes this lack of appreciation even of our. It is an extraordinary model that works extremely, extremely very well, and it explains so far everything to very, very high accuracy. Now this is the part we know. Okay, if we extrapolate this, and sometimes we do, what we expect to see of the picture is something that maybe somebody can imagine right now. Whether this is what we are going to find or not is something that remains to be seen. We talked about the standard model, we talked about supersymmetry and how it connects with dark matter and the observations of the universe. We talked a little bit about strings and extra dimensions and how they're coming into the big picture. But this is all, and I will say again, this is we can test with the LHC by producing the phenomena. We can also observe the phenomena, and this is why we have a full scientific and technological program of missions in space, so that we observe the phenomena in space. Here on Earth, we can recreate the phenomena. The additional value of recreating the phenomena is that we have the control. We can make more of these interactions, we can study them in a controlled laboratory environment, and we can reproduce them. So it's not a happening, it's we reproduce it. So it's important to understand the consilience of this. And I will close here. This is a cartoon that I stole from David from many years ago, where he shows how knowledge is working. We are in places that we understand what's going on, the places of the light, and then we're pushing out in the darkness, and every endeavor, every scientific endeavor that we are taking on is pushing a little bit towards outside. Thank you.
So now Maria is going to go through the audience and ask questions. But I thought we'd reverse it and have people. We have run over, and it's really my fault.
I'm sorry for that. I went over
and
way much.
And we have, as usual, refreshments out in the commons room. But I'm sure this wonderful talk has raised many questions, and we usually have such great questions. I don't want to deprive Maria of that, the other side.
Yes, please.
So please, we'll do this for some minutes. And we have a few microphones.
Thank you. When you were giving the list of what dark matter is not, you said black holes probably not. How do you know that?
That's a good question. Our astrophysicist friends, they have actually made a very good balance of how much helium, how much hydrogen, how much nitrogen is in the universe that accounts for all let's say, the visible matter. For black holes, unless these black holes are small planetary type of objects, like with one solar mass, with the theory and the experimental evidence that we have so far from nucleosynthesis and the primordial, everything that happened from the Big Bang, inflation, everything that happened, all the theory that we have in the experimentation, is coming up that this is okay. However, I said probably, because there might be, because black holes we don't understand very well, in a sense, and if there are small black holes of the size of the moon, or then it is possible that we, but it is highly unlikely, but we cannot exclude this, I think. And that's why I wrote probably not. So there is a chance, although in our galaxy, for example, we haven't seen such objects that they are small and they could fit with a black hole, and that they would have an abundance that they will be in the clusters that we observe that have dark matter. Okay. Well, that's also an interesting question. In the LSST picture that I showed you, and in the simulations that they're having, the dark matter is the way it clumps and the way it was like or it cusps in the middle is a subject of a lot of research right now for the people that they are doing this observational, experimental and observational dark matter and making the theories of whether it clumps, of whether it is stretched and how it is. In the LSST picture that I showed you of the bullet cluster, it showed like there was a cusp in the middle. But this is now being researched, how exactly. The dark matter interactions with itself are also not exactly clear.
There is a project in Europe right now called ELI, Extreme Light Infrastructure, to build the most powerful laser in the world in order to be able to break vacuum. Because Schrödinger predicted many years ago the electric field you need is 10 to the 29 watt per centimeter squared. The idea is to make a laser of that intensity. Do you think it'll be able to compete with your accelerator?
Well, I mean, these experiments are experiments, as you said. These experiments are experiments that they are probing the quantum, basically predictions of quantum mechanics. And for what concerns what we are doing in you're talking about Higgs.
Very high field laser that would produce electron positron pairs, which is very low energy. This is effectively MEVs.
So if this is the case, then it is not relevant for this at all. Yes.
I can do it. Okay. I have what might be a really simple question that just might be that I'm not quite getting the vocabulary. But you said that the dark matter might be both heavy and weak. And right. I wondered why.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
So the part which is heavy is referring to the mass of the dark matter. Okay. So it can be, it is an object that it is massive, but it interacts with matter in a weakly way, so it zips through. So if there is dark matter candidates from supersymmetry, they can pass through our bodies right now, completely undetected. But the mass of the particle is actually heavy. Now the thing that you can think as the thing that you can think of is like a massive neutrino. Okay, so and the neutrino is not massless exactly as we have found out. It has a small mass, but if it had a bigger mass, it interacts weakly. So the couplings, the interactions with ordinary matter are small. So that's why the neutrinos zip through. And similarly, dark matter particles in that category that they are coming from supersymmetry are weakly interacting, and they are massive. In order That's how they are coming from the theory, and this is good for what we see from the universe, because we need this kind of particle in order to cover for the abundance, for how much we have. Okay?
I too have a very basic question. Is the LHC circular because the particles go around and around faster and faster and faster and faster, as opposed to long and linear of the same length as the diameter? And how do you control ultimate collisions? Because if particles are going around many times and accelerating, mm-hmm. there must be some collisions between low energy particles and high energy particles. Mm-hmm. So do you control those collisions, or do you just look at the impact and then infer what the speed and mass power must have been?
Mm-hmm. So let me start from the first. In particle physics, we started with circular machines. We went into linear machines. We went into circular machines for both electrons and protons. And the situation was the following about 10 years ago, that we cannot anymore have a circular machine that it is electrons, because there is a lot of energy that the electrons lose in photons, bremsstrahlung, when they're going around. So the last electron circular collider is out of the way, the one that it is circular. This is why we're going into linear colliders now. Now, for the protons, you couldn't make the electrons go that fast, because they lose a lot of energy by emitting photons as they are going fast. This is called bremsstrahlung. The protons also have bremsstrahlung, but it is less. So that means that every time you go around, if you lose a lot of energy by emitting other particles, it means that you have to pump more energy, and then your electric bill is going to be very bad, and you keep losing a lot of energy. You don't want that. So the circular accelerator has the advantage that for every round you can add more energy. All more energy, and if you let me show you the little clip, it would show you exactly how it happens. Of course, you don't have one proton, you have bunches of them, and you have to be extremely careful with your so-called optics, the equivalent of optics, in order to keep them in line, in order to keep them with very small diameters, in order to steer them, because it is, of course, not exactly circular, okay? So you have to steer, you have to have a steering wheel. The steering wheel is all the different kinds of magnets. So there are octuples, sextuples, quadruples, there are the magnets that are keeping it together. And all these magnets act as lenses, like lenses focus, defocus the light. And the purpose is sometimes you want to defocus the beam to spread it, synchronize it, and bring it back together with a focusing magnet. And this is, again, one of the points of how technologically extremely challenging it is when you're having billions of these particles and these beams that they're going at the speed of light, practically, and you have to bunch them, debunch them, and bring them to collisions at less than the diameter of a hair. I mean, the collision point of these billions of particles is coming at the 16 microns at the Atlas one. Also, the beams are coming, some are collided horizontally on the horizontal plane with some angle in CMS, and on the vertical plane with some angle with Atlas. The reason why the manipulation of how you put crossing angles is such that when you have the bunch of particles colliding together, you can have a lot of hadronic sprays and you can lose a lot of them. You don't want to be losing them. You want to be circulating them. This is called the lifetime of the beam. You don't want to put the beam and in an hour all the particles are gone. You have a few collisions and they're gone. You want to keep it for a long time. So the mechanics of how exactly you put the beams together and the accelerator technology in physics, it's humbling for us that we are. I don't know much about that. I know what they are telling me, and it is extremely fascinating and difficult what these people are doing.
When the beams are colliding head-on,
They are colliding, they can be made to collide in an angle. In the beginning, they will collide head-on when they are at small energies, and then they can be made to collide in an angle.
Points. But before they collide, they can be bent.
Yes, they can
be bent. They collide at very small angles.
Though. Yes.
Why don't you get this one? Joe?
I am curious to understand what explains the huge size of the different detectors.
Ha! Very good question. Very, very good question. Can we bring this up?
Repeat the question.
The question is, how do you explain the different size of the two detectors? Please, can I have this up, please? Okay, first I will tell you in a parenthesis that those detectors in around the 1980s, I would say, they were thought of that they will discover the Higgs boson. I will put the Higgs here as a Higgs, and one of the reactions of the Higgs in how it decays, if it is above the mass, if it is above some mass of 150 GeV, let's say, 1 GeV is the mass of the proton, then it decays to two Zs, or a Z and a Z star, which is some quantum thing of the Z. A Z particle is the Z boson that we talked about. The Zs decay into two muons. So they were thinking at the time, a muon and another muon. They were thinking at the time that the discoveries will be a four muon final state of the detector. Where are you there? So they said, how do I design a detector that will detect a muon, which is a charged particle that will have, let's say, this is the center of the collision. There will be a Higgs. Immediately it will decay into the Zs. Immediately they will decay into four muons, so you will have four muons. Let's say this is one muon. And I want to measure this muon. I want to measure it with a precision of no worse than 10%. And I want to measure this muon with this precision in a range of energies between 20 and 1 TeV, 20 GeV. Every time there is a GeV, it's the mass of the proton, 20 times the mass of the proton, and this is 10 tera electron volts. So giga is 10 to the 3, another tera is 10 to the 3. So they want to cover all this range, and they want to do this. Now, this is a delta P over P relation, where P is the momentum. So if you want to calculate this, and we can make the calculation another time, in order to get this, the resolution is the error on the measurement over the measurement of the momentum. The momentum is the opposite of the curvature. The curvature is determined by how big the magnetic field is, which I will call B, and then this. In order to have this precision, the equation that you're going to have to solve is something that goes as BL squared, where L is the length of the detector, okay, how big it is, and the magnetic field. So now, how many options do you have? You can have a huge magnetic field and a small L, to get the precision you want, because it goes with a BL squared, magnetic field times length squared. Now you have the square, this is a big thing. So you have a huge magnetic field with a small L, and that's a compact muon solenoid. The solenoidal field here is 4 Tesla. It's small, as you saw in the dimensions that I showed you. Or you can have a very large toroidal, which is approximately half toroidal, which is approximately half the magnetic field of that, so it's about 2-point-something Tesla, small magnetic field, and a very large L. Okay? So now we've got two dual detectors, one that it is small with a very high magnetic field that curves the particle very highly, and one that it is very large with smaller magnetic field. The science that these two are going to produce is exactly the same. You can have many in between also. So you could build your intermediate detector that could do the same physics with an intermediate magnetic field and an intermediate L. But this is a very, very good question, and the determination of the specification of the material, of how you are going to build it, with what material for the calorimeters that capture the electrons, with what material that you're going to do the tracking, with how much money you're going to put, is determined by this, how you're going to choose your field and the length of the detector. This is the difference between CMS and Atlas. In the end, they cost it the same, we say, but in reality... You want the movie? Yes, we can play the movie. The movie is only 4 minutes, okay? But it's a good graphic, I think.
Synchrotron is sick. Insignificant though this bottle of compressed hydrogen gas looks, it marks the beginning of the world's largest and most powerful particle accelerator chain, culminating in CERN's spectacular Large Hadron Collider. Hydrogen.
What happened? No. Something went, it stopped or?
I'm right.
I wanted to start it from the... from the point with the graphic. This is from the day, this is from the day of the...
gas looks. It marks the beginning.
Official lot. Official.
Insignificant though this bottle of compressed hydrogen gas looks, it marks the beginning of the world's largest and most powerful particle accelerator chain, culminating in CERN's spectacular Large Hadron Collider. Hydrogen atoms from this gas cylinder are fed at a precisely controlled rate into the source chamber of a linear accelerator, CERN's LINAC-2, where their electrons are stripped off to leave hydrogen nuclei. These are protons and have a positive charge, enabling them to be accelerated by an electric field. Their journey to eventually take part in ultra-high energy collisions, similar to those following the Big Bang, can now begin. This initial acceleration has caused Linnet 2 to be likened to the lumbering first stage of a huge rocket. By the time this packet of protons leaves Linnet 2, it'll be travelling at one-third the speed of light. It's about to enter the booster, stage 2 of the rocket, if you will. In order to maximise the intensity of the beam, the packet is divided up into four, one for each of the booster's rings. Straight acceleration is now impractical, and the booster is circular, 157 metres in circumference. In order to accelerate the packets, they are repeatedly circulated, and the electric field is now pulsed, in the same way that you push a child on a swing each time they reach a certain point. Magnets exert a force on the passing protons at right angles to their direction of motion, and so powerful electromagnets are used to bend the beam of protons round the circle. The booster accelerates the protons up to 91.6% of the speed of light and squeezes them closer together. Recombining the packet from the four rings, it's then flung on into the proton synchrotron, by analogy, stage 3 of our rocket. Let's just follow two such proton packets. The proton synchrotron is 628 meters in circumference, and they circulate for 1.2 seconds, reaching over 99.9% of the velocity of light. It's here that the point of transition is reached, a point where the energy added to the protons by the pulsating electric field cannot translate into increased velocity, as they're already approaching the limiting speed of light. Instead, the added energy manifests itself as increasing mass of the protons. In short, the protons can't go faster, so they get heavier. The microscopic kinetic energy of each proton is measured in units called electron volts, and now the energy of each proton has risen to 25 giga electron volts, or GeV. The protons are now 25 times heavier than they are at rest. The packets of protons are now channeled into stage 4, the superproton synchrotron, a huge ring 7 kilometers in circumference, designed specifically to accept protons at this energy and increase it to 450 GeV. Soon, the packets of protons will be energized sufficiently to be launched into the orbit of the gigantic Large Hadron Collider, or LHC, which lies between the Jura Mountains and the Alps, and straddles both France and Switzerland. Lying deep underground, it has a circumference of 27 kilometers. There are two vacuum pipes within the LHC, containing proton beams traveling in opposite directions. Using ultra-sophisticated kickers to synchronize incoming packets with those already circulating, one vacuum pipe has injected into it protons which will circulate clockwise, and the other protons which will circulate anti-clockwise. The counter-rotating beams cross over in the four detector caverns, where they can be made to collide. The energy of the collision is double that of the individual opposing protons, and it's the debris from these collisions that is tracked in the detectors. For half an hour, the SPS injects protons. Finally, there are 2,808 packets. During this time, the LHC adds extra energy to each proton, whose velocity is now so near the speed of light that it goes round the 27-kilometer ring over 11,000 times each second, getting a boost of energy at each revolution from the pulsed electric field. Finally, each proton has an energy of 7 tera electron volts, and they're 7,000 times heavier than at rest. The magnetic force needed to keep the beams bending to the ring is so enormous that nearly 12,000 amps must flow through its electromagnets. This is achieved by making the LHC colder than outer space, so that its magnets become superconducting. Now the protons are ready to collide in the detectors. A steering magnet finally brings them onto a collision course. The total energy of two protons colliding in the LHC is 14 tera electron volts and reproduces similar states to moments after the Big Bang. Particle tracks from these collisions will be analyzed by computers connected to the detectors, and it's hoped these tracks will give a new insight into the very birth of our universe. How our universe has evolved, what governs its behavior today, and where it's going in the future.
Thank you, everybody. Yes.